This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jason Patinkin, and here's what's coming up.
We don't have a sense of how it's going to shake out right now. I think what it does do is put much more emphasis on the other G5 countries, and I think it's going to probably reinforce the already very strong tendency to look for stability or kind of short-term stability over anything else.
That was Andrew Leibovich, an African policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations think tank. He was talking about the impact of Chad President Idriss Deby's death on the fight against terrorism in the Sahel region. This story and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Our top story today is in Chad. Few countries are feeling the loss of Chad's President Idriss Deby more keenly than former colonial power France. Paris has long seen Deby as a key ally in the fight against terrorism in the Sahel. Now some observers say his death brings uncertainty to this campaign and for France's hopes for an eventual drawdown of its force in the region. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA from Paris.
La France perd un allié essentiel dans la lutte contre le terrorisme au Sahel.
The loss of a courageous friend. That's how President Macron's office has described the death of Idriss Deby, a statement echoed by French Defense Minister Florence Parly. She said Chad's slain leader had been an essential ally in the fight against terrorism in the Sahel, noting Chad had only recently deployed a new 1,200-member battalion to the high-risk three-border zone straddling Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. Some experts now wonder if that force will now be diminished as Chad faces multiple sources of instability at home. Over Deby's 30-year rule, France and other Western partners saw him as a key military ally in the region. They were willing to do business despite his undemocratic practices. Analysts today called Deby's death an especially big blow for Paris.
C'était vraiment quelque part l'homme de la France dans la région qui a les seules troupes aguerries.
Geopolitical specialist Antoine Glaser told France's Europe 1 radio that Deby was seen as France's man in the region, supporting its previous Operation Serval, which turned into today's 5,100-man Barkhane anti-terrorist operation in the Sahel. Glaser said Deby's death will be a hard blow for Macron's hopes to reduce France's military role in the region. Instead, he said, France may now have to worry about Chad's own instability. Andrew Leibovich is an Africa policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations think tank.
Particularly since the intervention in Mali in 2013, Chad has been one of the key anti-terrorism partners in the region for France. And even before that, of course, France has been a quite steadfast supporter of Idriss Deby.
Chad has been the biggest troop contributor to the G5 Sahel force France partners with to fight the jihadist insurgency in the region. France's Barkhane operation is headquartered in Chad's capital, N'Djamena. Other countries part of the G5 Sahel, also including Mauritania, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. Chad's soldiers are considered the most battle-hardened and professional, those sent on the most difficult missions. Deby's death might change that.
We don't have a sense of how it's going to shake out right now. I think what it does do is put much more emphasis on the other G5 countries, and I think it's going to probably reinforce the already very strong tendency to look for stability or kind of short-term stability over anything else.
Analysts say the military support between France and Chad has gone both ways. Over the years, Paris assisted Deby as he faced armed insurgencies. That includes in 2019, when French forces conducted airstrikes on a rebel offensive coming from Libya.
2006, 2008, encore 2019, où Emmanuel Macron...
Journalist Vincent Hugeux told Radio France International, Paris's assistance had essentially become a French doctrine of saving soldier Deby. Reports quoting an announcement by military officials say Debbie died from battlefield wounds suffered during a visit to troops during the latest such insurgency. The Front for Change and Concord in Chad, or FACT rebel group, now says it will march on N'Djamena. It rejects the country's new transitional military council set up after Debbie's death and presided by his son, Mohamed Idris Debbie, a four-star general. So do some opposition leaders. Experts say while Debbie's son is likely to continue Chad's G5 Sahel presence, it may be reduced. And they are uncertain whether the transitional council, which promises elections after an 18-month rule, is sustainable without Idris Debbie's strong personality. All of this, they say, equals uncertainty and worry for France and Chad's regional partners. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Chad's army has blamed Debbie's death on a rebel group called the Front for Change and Concord in Chad, or FACT. FACT has been based in Libya to Chad's north and is linked to Libyan rebel General Khalifa Haftar. To find out more about the FACT group and details of Debbie's death, I reached out to Chad researcher Jerome Toubiana in France. Jerome, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem.
So first of all, what can you tell us about this group, this rebel group FACT, and its leader?
It's pretty much a classical Chadian rebel group. Its leader, Mohamed Mahdi, has been a really long-time rebel. He was part of actually the early Chadian rebellion since the 1970s. I think at the time he was pretty much a child soldier rebel. And since then he's been a rebel in various movements. And then he was also in exile in France for a long time, and he went to Libya to take the leadership of the rebels who had moved from Sudan and North Chad to Libya in the years 2015. And then actually they started to splinter, and he found himself literally trapped into the area controlled by General Haftar in Libya. He managed to conclude some kind of non-aggression pact with Haftar and to somehow work alongside him. But it's a bit odd because Haftar is also very close to the Chadian government and the French government. So you had on the same side Chadian rebels and the Chadian government in Libya.
Now, it's the army who announced that the rebels killed Debbie. Is that confirmed by any other sources?
There was also a lot of information from the rebels, and there are not that much difference between the government information and the rebel information on the fighting itself. Including on the fact that there were heavy losses from both sides, including on the side of the army. At least five generals were killed, according to both the rebels and the government. And ultimately, I got the information that Debbie was killed, or actually died from his injuries, from sources very close to the rebels. So it looks like it's confirmed, and I don't see much difference between both versions.
And, you know, it's quite surprising for a head of state to be killed on the battlefield. From the Chadian government perspective, what went wrong here?
It's not the first time that Debbie goes to fight himself and to lead the troops, to lead operations on the ground. He already did it in 2008 and was almost killed. And even this time, I heard before he was injured, he was almost killed at the same time than two generals. At that time was not injured, and then he was injured the next day, according to what I heard. So it's customary and in Chad to do that, and people say that the troops don't fight if the big officers are not in the first car, basically, on the front line. The result of that is that losses of big officers are common. I think Debbie also wanted to make sure that his army would actually fight and remain mobilized and not betray him, because in recent years there's been a lot of dissatisfaction growing within the army.
You mentioned this dissatisfaction. Are there any fractures in the Chadian military so far?
There were indications of fractures in the army in recent years. The army remobilized to fight in the last days, but it's not sure that it will remain as mobilized now that Debbie is dead. I'm not sure the army will fully support the rapidly established transitional military council.
That's Chad researcher Jerome Toubiana speaking to me from France. Jerome, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Take care.
Leaders of the Transitional Military Council in Chad are promising to hand over power to a civilian government after free elections within 18 months. The council's Vice President Jim Adum Taraina addressed diplomats yesterday after the president's son, General Mahamat Idriss Deby, signed documents as he assumed leadership of the Central African nation. In his address to the diplomats, Taraina pledged to fulfill the international commitments assumed during Deby's government and, quote, fight relentlessly against terrorism, end quote, alongside Chad's allies. Still, the fact rebels have vowed to capture N'Djamena, which is the capital of the oil-rich nation. The U.S. State Department offered condolences to the people of Chad and said the U.S. supports a, quote, peaceful transition of power in accordance with the Chadian Constitution, end quote. State Department spokesman Ned Price went on to say that the U.S. would continue to partner with Sahel states in the G5 group to battle extremist insurgencies in the region. Deby had been active in the G5 effort. In addition, Price said that given the continued uncertainty in Chad, non-essential U.S. Embassy staff and family members in the country still are being ordered to leave. Meanwhile, the UN Refugee Agency reports that more than 2,000 refugees have fled to southern Chad to escape fighting between government forces and rebel groups in the Central African Republic. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Newly arriving refugees have been telling aid workers in Chad of the mayhem engulfing their region. The refugees who come from CAR's northern Kaga-Bandoro region describe shocking acts of violence, looting and extortion by rebel groups as government forces were closing in on them. As people were fleeing toward the Chadian border, UN refugee spokesman Baba Baluch says other people from towns they passed along the way joined them, fearing that they too would come under rebel attack.
To reach Chad, people had to wade shoulder deep through the Grand Sido River, with some carrying their few belongings on their heads. The refugees are now settled in Gandaza village inside Chad on the other side of the border, although some are having to resort to cross back into CAR to find food or salvage what little is left from their properties.
Chad is hosting nearly 11,000 of the 117,000 Central African refugees who have fled violence sparked by CAR's contested presidential and parliamentary elections in December. Most of the refugees, about 92,000, have fled to the Democratic Republic of Congo. Several thousand others have taken refuge in neighboring Cameroon and the Republic of Congo. The country has enjoyed a period of relative calm since mid-March, after government forces and their allies reclaimed most of the rebel strongholds. Baluch says the newly arrived refugees are in urgent need of shelter, food and water, as well as access to sanitation and health care.
UNHCR's ability to meet their basic requirements is severely constrained by lack of funding and resources. The CAR humanitarian situation is one of the most underfunded UNHCR's operation globally, with only 12% of the required $164 million needed.
Post-election violence also has displaced 164,000 people inside the country. CAR's decade-long war has uprooted nearly one-third of its 4.7 million population. The United Nations reports 2.8 million people, more than half of the population, needs international aid and protection. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And in Nigeria, news media report today that gunmen attacked Greenfield University in Kaduna State last night and abducted an unknown number of students. Details are still coming in, but police say that as soon as they got word of the attack, officers and soldiers headed to the school. Greenfield University is a private university located along the Abuja-Kaduna Highway. Islamist extremists and suspected bandits have kidnapped scores of students from schools in northern Nigeria in recent years. Now in the United States, a jury yesterday found White's former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin guilty of all charges in the death of black man George Floyd, an incident that inflamed racial tensions and sparked protests across the United States and abroad. Chauvin was convicted of second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. He will be sentenced in about 2 months and faces decades in prison. Floyd was suspected of using a counterfeit $20 bill at a store last May as Chauvin and three other officers attempted to arrest him. Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck for about 9 minutes. Shortly after the verdict was announced on live national television, President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris spoke to the nation. Biden said the verdict, quote, can be a giant step forward in the march toward justice, end quote. Minorities have long complained about unfair treatment by police and the judicial system in the United States. On the streets of Minneapolis, thousands of people reacted with relief over the verdict. VOA's Somali service was there and gathered reactions. Omar Fateh is a senator in the Minnesota state legislature representing the South Minneapolis district in which George Floyd was killed.
Today is a day of accountability, but justice was not fully served. Today is just a day of an accountability. One officer has been charged for murder. There are three officers left in this case that aided and helped George and helped Derek Chauvin murder George Floyd. So today's a very good day. It's a very good start. And we're proud of what happened so far. It happened because the people on the ground, the protesters, the organizers, the neighbors, they came out and they applied pressure.
Minneapolis resident Zainab Mohammed was waiting to hear the verdict outside the courtroom. Here's what she had to say after it was announced.
My perspective is that we know that justice system worked today. So why hasn't it worked the last over 400 years? Why hasn't it worked for the 470 people that have been killed by the state of Minnesota? And that now it's time to continuously put pressure on it and that people need to be on the ground to bring more justice.
Our thanks to VOA Somali Service for bringing us those voices. Now in Algeria, 8 rights groups have warned that a hunger strike by 23 people detained during the country's Hirak protest movement risks serious health complications and even death. The rights groups say the detentions on charges of, quote, disrupting national unity, end quote, are arbitrary and contrary to their constitutional rights. The hunger strike is in protest of both the detention and the conditions in custody, which they say are inhumane. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, discussed the situation in Algeria with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The protesters are correct. Detentions are arbitrary and in violation of the letter and spirit of the new constitution. The Algerian government has said this has to do with the COVID-19 pandemic, but the charges have nothing to do with violating the pandemic. It's damage to national unity for protesting and unarmed gathering. So these are all contrary to the free speech rights in the constitution. These hunger strikers were arrested almost 3 weeks ago. They've been hunger striking for 2 weeks. One of them is 60 years old and in frail condition. Another one has diabetes and lost consciousness. There's no reason for them to be in prison for simply protesting. I think they have a court hearing today, and there's another protest planned in Geneva and other ones in Algeria to try to get them out of detention later in the week. But basically, there's a new crackdown going on Hirak protesters, promises to release those who've been jailed. Some get released, some stay in detention, but it's all fairly arbitrary.
With the return of popular protests demanding a civilian state, freedom of expression, and an independent judiciary, what are the prospects of change in Algeria?
For the short term, quite low, but for the long term, quite high. The population of Algeria has remobilized since the anniversary of the Hirak 2 years ago, and with the 20th anniversary of the Black Spring, which brought a lot of people out this week. And that is going to continue. Social conditions continue to degrade in Algeria, and that is causing a number of opposition politicians to put out alerts on how we could have an impending social explosion. Cost of living is up, inflation is up, purchasing power is down, employment is down. So all of this is pushing more people out in the street for a mixture of political and economic reasons. The main problem for change has been that a lot of consensus among Algerians about what needs changing, but the lists of demands are often sort of poorly articulated, and there's an anti-politics deriving Algerian oppositional politics, particularly among youth, which says we don't want political leaders, we don't want political parties. And eventually, if you want to change the system, you have to organize politically beyond just protesting. And hopefully this process will continue.
The latest State Department human rights report cited a variety of human rights violations in Algeria. How would that impact the U.S. policy toward Algeria, as President Biden pledged to make human rights a driving force in U.S. foreign policy?
Well, it won't help the relationship on either side. Last year, the Algerians arrested hundreds of journalists and human rights and political activists. They shut down newspapers and websites. They passed laws that criminalize criticism of the authorities. And so all of that leads to a degradation in Algeria and a degradation of the relationship. When you shut down civil society in new ways, you're going to get this type of criticism. The Biden administration, with every country in the world, they have to do both, work with the country in these areas if they're willing to work on them, and work on counterterrorism and other issues of higher priority. In this case, however, counterterrorism is directly linked to the human rights files. So if Algeria is willing to work with the U.S., there can be training, security forces, there can be, you know, working together on improvements in prisons there. Algeria has rejected most of this on sovereigntist grounds, and they take criticism quite negatively. But ultimately, and the overall situation, both on the human rights side and the counterterrorism side, will improve if treatment of Algerian civil society and protesting civilians improves.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy. And in Uganda, long-distance truck drivers are calling for the intervention of the East African community to address insecurity that is threatening business in neighboring South Sudan. The call follows four armed attacks on a cargo fleet along the Nimule-Juba Highway, which connects Uganda to the South Sudanese capital. Those attacks took place between March 17th and 30th. Catherine Nambi reports for VOA from Kampala.
After ending a 10-day sit-down strike at the Uganda-South Sudan border town of Elegu, East African truck drivers have resumed travel to South Sudan. However, they are asking regional governments to press South Sudan to ensure that the drivers are given maximum security to and from the country. This follows continuing attacks on the truckers, which have resulted in injuries and the loss of lives and property. Geoffrey Ocheng Osborne is the resident district commissioner of Amuru District in Uganda. He mentions some of the decisions reached at the high-level meeting with South Sudan officials before the drivers resumed business.
We arrived at 8 key resolutions that the government of South Sudan must provide security and escort to all trucks delivering cargo goods and services to South Sudan, as well as escort the returning trucks back to border respectively. Another resolution was for government of South Sudan to find a permanent solution to the insecurity along highways. The government of South Sudan to withdraw all roadblocks and checkpoints alleged to be extorting money from truck drivers.
The truckers also want compensation for colleagues who have lost their lives or have been injured, and for those who have lost property in the recent attacks. Sudi Mwatela is the organizing secretary of Kenya Long Distance Truck Drivers Union.
The ambassadors who came to the meeting, who we demanded them to come for the negotiation of compensation and the assurance of the security that we demanded in Southern Sudan. And they asked to take the responsibility of the negotiation about the compensation. They told us to give them some months and we gave them 90 days to do the consultation of how they are going to conduct the compensation. All the names, those injured and the trucks that were burnt in Southern Sudan, almost 30 trucks. The names we submitted, 48, those who lost their lives and those injured.
According to the truckers, if the security situation remains fragile along the routes to Juba in South Sudan, they'll be forced to stop at the Ugandan side of the border with their merchandise. Male Zedi is the assistant chairperson of the Uganda Long Distance Truck Drivers Association.
Let us bring those things from Uganda, from Kenya. Let us offload here in Elegu. Yes. And those one in South Sudan, let them come and pick here from Uganda side.
Yes. Yeah.
Because when you cross the border, no any security. There is no security in that road. Even for those one, you pay migration. They take a lot of money from Nimr to Juba.
There has been increasing armed violence against truckers in East Africa since 2016. About 15 drivers are reported to have died in the latest spate of attacks that have included hijackings, shootings, assaults, and looting. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. Thank you for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America. Stay safe, stay healthy.